are listening to a free version of The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, September 22nd, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Andrew Sayre, professor of social theory and political economy at Lancaster University, UK, and author of Why We Can't Afford the Rich. Also on the program today, the only question yet to be asked, or answered, I should say, is how many executives from Volkswagen will go to prison for this? And why I think Martin Shkreli, I think that's how you pronounce his name, should go to prison. Even without really technically committing a crime. And a peanut executive will go to prison for the killing, essentially, of nine people via his product. Also on the program today, Scott Walker. Bye-bye. We didn't expect it would happen so quickly. But Scott Walker, bye-bye. Also on the program, Hillary Clinton comes out with a drug plan that deviates from Obamacare in a way that I think you'll all appreciate. And Ben Carson's still insane. Democrats will be also offering a climate bill sure to not pass with Republicans, but will certainly stick in their craw, as it were, because, well, as you know, the Pope is coming to town, and the Pope apparently is supportive of climate change legislation. So, what's that?
I'm that one congressman who's booing.
Oh, right. That what was the name of that guy? Did we ever find it? We never found that guy, right?
I believe that the Pope is being led by the lunar calendar.
Paul Gosar.
Well, I'm pretty sure I spoke about him the other day, who did not appreciate the theology of the Pope because he was talking about climate change as opposed to, I don't know, I guess the war within what's inside of women, as Ben Carson would put it. The Democrats will be offering a bill sponsored by Maria Cantwell of Washington. The measure would establish the U.S. policy as U.S. policy, a reduction of greenhouse gas emissions by 2% each year through 2025, which is a cut even larger than the target set by the Obama administration. The bill would direct the United States to use its leadership to secure commitments from other countries to cut emissions. The measure would require electric utilities to increase energy efficiency by 20% from current levels by 2030. It would also extend tax credits for electric utilities that use wind and solar power, increase spending on research into energy-efficient trucks and factories, and enact policies that would make it cheaper for consumers to invest in their own solar power. And that is becoming, I think that is all in our future. The question is, how quickly will it get here and how much will it upset the Republicans for the Democrats playing politics with climate change, playing politics with politics, essentially. We're going to take a break and get to Andrew Sayre in a moment. But I want to remind you that Next Issue Media is offering a free trial right now for ongoing web access and subscriptions to some premium magazines. Magazines like People, Vogue, Esquire, Time. Next Issue lets you dive deeper into a story with interactive content for a richer reading experience. You want premium content, but you don't want to run around looking for it. Next Issue is the mobile app that lets you tap directly into the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using your phone or tablet. I've already talked about some of the magazines they have here. The New Yorker. Sports Illustrated, Wood. I do, guys in this office know that I'm a little bit of a woodworker. I'm a little bit of a hack, but I still like to read the magazines.
To tinker.
Michael enjoys Wine Enthusiastic, a wine enthusiast.
Indeed. Indubitably.
And GQ, right? Harper's Bazaar.
I like GQ. That is true. I do like GQ. I'm not going to lie about that.
HGTV. I'm sort of partial to those type of things. Field and Stream. Food and Wine. They got all of them. Architectural Digest. Backpacker.
No Red Bull Quarterly.
Right. I was going to say, Matt. There's no junk food,
Do you see Pro Wrestling Illustrated on that?
No, I'm sorry, but National Geographic, Town and Country. They have an amazing number of magazines here. Rolling Stone. Next Issue is offering a free trial right now when you go to nextissue.com/majority. That's Next Issue, as in the next issue, .com/majority. You can try it for free right now. Check out the app. See if they got magazines that interest you. It's hard for me to believe that they don't. Women's Health. That's so that Michael can go and sound like he's actually like empathetic and knowledgeable on his dates. Right? Isn't that what you read to bone up?
Bone up? All right, Sam.
Please.
Yeah, good
Come
job,
on.
Dude. Move on.
Come
Be
on.
Mature.
Bon Appetit.
That's more appropriate.
What is Boys Life?
Oh, you don't. That's like a Boy Scouts type magazine.
Oh, really?
Young.
Well, you
kids.
Could you yeah. share that with Ezra when he gets old enough?
I used to get that when I was young.
Did you really?
Yeah.
I never even heard of it.
It was like for kids who like to do like outdoor stuff.
All right. Fair enough. You don't strike me as that guy, but...
I wasn't. I don't remember why I got the magazine.
Nextissue.com/majority. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Andrew Sayre on his book, Why We Can't Afford the Rich.
Exit wound in a foreign nation, showing the home of the one this was written for. My apartment looks upside down from there. Water spirals the wrong way out the sink. And her voice is a backwards record. It's like a whirlpool and it never ends. And the anger now are getting old, and we still haven't walked in the glow of each other's majestic presence. Listen and hear my words, to the ones you would
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Andrew Sayer. He is a professor of social theory and political economy at Lancaster University in the UK and author of his recently published Why We Can't Afford the Rich. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So let's start with your three-point breakdown of neoliberalism. I think this audience we've discussed many times sort of the idea of neoliberalism, but it's one of those terms that I think sort of always needs to be defined up front by those who are using it, and then we will go from there. But give us the sort of that the 3-point breakdown of neoliberalism, sort of the essence that and its features.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the first one, which everybody I think most commonly mentions, is the idea that markets are the best form, the default form of economic organization, the superior form, and we need to privatize as much as possible in order to allow markets to control everything. And so privatization, deregulation, especially of financial markets, freeing up markets so market actors can do whatever they want, that's the first thing. The second thing is a change, is more cultural in a way. It's a shift in emphasis from regarding ourselves as citizens, members of the public, to individual consumers, but also as individuals who look upon ourselves as commodities for sale little enterprises. We encourage young people, even in primary schools in the UK now, to work on their curriculum vitae. I think you call them vitae or resume in the States, don't you?
Indeed.
Which is basically packaging themselves, presenting themselves as an entrepreneurial individual, and
I'd
everybody
add,
against there, everybody else.
There's so been there's been
the cultural side of it. That's the second point. Yeah.
There's been a decent amount of writing about how sort of Facebook and Instagram and these type of social media sites are also set up that way, right? I mean, my daughter, at 10 years old, has already been trained to put out, you know, to take photos that are, that receive more likes than anything else. And it's disturbing, and it's also hard for me to even to critique her on it, because on some level, I mean, that's sort of the business that I am in on some level, you know, doing a podcast, doing a radio show, doing YouTube videos. But it's amazing how much it's permeated our culture.
Yeah. And it's not without some positive elements to it, but it also encourages this individualistic view of the world where we're competing with every other individual. And we're not like actually, our human nature is that we are social beings. We are dependent on others, most obviously when we're children and when we're very old, but we absolutely depend upon others, and we flourish best when others around us flourish too. But the third point is that, you know, you asked the 3 points. Well, the third one is one which perhaps others, I think, have missed a bit, which is that it's very much to do with a shift in power, economic and political, towards the rich. And this is well documented now that in rich countries like the US and the UK and Canada and so on, a huge shift and concentration of wealth at the very top. And with that goes a concentration of political power. And that's very clear certainly in American politics and British politics. So it's that change in the balance of power from a broadly democratic one to what you might call a plutocratic one. Plutocracy simply means rule of the rich, where they dominate the democratic politics. And we can see that with Trump. We can see that with Cameron and so on.
Well, this is a bit off topic. I mean, I have a sense of how that dynamic has played out in the States, going basically from a plutonomy to a plutocracy. And we've seen a lot of research that has come out to show that when there are contested issues that Congress is looking at, they will resolve not based on party breakdowns or ideological breakdowns per se, but basically where the rich end up favoring. What is the sense? And I have a sense of what that dynamic is in this country. But I mean, if just briefly, again, this is a little bit off topic. But what drives that in Great Britain? Is it more or less the same dynamic, or how does it work within the context of British politics?
Well, there are some similarities in that, in order to get elected, it's been increasingly the case over the last 30 years that parties need to win a lot of support, and they need to get support from big business, especially from finance. And they're very glad to have that financial support, of course. And so what the major companies and major financial companies do is to hedge their bets and offer money in exchange for policies which suit them, of course, to whichever parties look like having a decent chance of winning the election. So, you know, Obama got lots of money from oil companies and from Goldman Sachs. And New Labour in Britain also got plenty of money from the financial sector. Not as much as the Conservatives, but nevertheless, they're paid basically to do the bidding of the rich and the super rich and corporations which work for them, basically.
So let's move on from there when we've sort of, I guess, you know, broadly speaking, defined neoliberalism and talk about the mechanisms of how the rich accumulate their wealth. And I'm particularly interested in the concept of rentiers.
I beg your pardon?
Of rentiers.
Of rent seeking, did you say?
Yes.
Sorry, the line isn't terribly good. Well, this is basically, it's an old idea made by a number of thinkers across the political spectrum, actually, which is that a significant amount of income is unearned. It's a free lunch, in effect. So if you own some land, then as Adam Smith said, you can reap where you have not sown. If other people need that land and don't have it themselves. So on the basis of owning and controlling either land or existing buildings, you can extract income from others without actually providing any new goods and services yourself. The buildings already exist. And okay, people should pay for maintenance and any redevelopment costs, but anything over and above that is basically a free lunch. And as Milton Friedman said, the Chicago economist, in a sense, that there isn't any, you can't have a free lunch because someone somewhere must put up the cost for providing it. So if you make a million on some property that you've got, which is just inflated in value because it's in the city center, say, you haven't done anything, but you get a windfall, a free lunch. But that $1 million can only have any value if other people who produce goods and services have produced more than they've consumed, but enough to provide you with whatever you want to buy with that $1 million. So you're free riding, basically, if you're in that situation, on the work of others.
Go ahead.
That's rent seeking. When you're specifically seeking out new sources of rent, which has become extremely important in neoliberalism.
And you also discussed the sort of reinterpret what we mean by terms like earnings and investment and wealth.
Yes.
Walk us through that.
Okay, well, earnings is the easiest one. Probably when a super rich person says in the U.S. that they've earned so many hundreds of millions in a year, a number of people will say, oh, yes, did they really earn it or did they just get it? And we slide between two meanings of the term. One is to deserve something. I earned that $100 or something, meaning, you know, I really worked hard for it, or I just got it. And we slide between those, which is very convenient. But the big one is the word investment, which sounds such a good thing, doesn't it? Who wouldn't want to be an investor? Makes you sound like a benefactor. Well, you may be. If you are actually putting money into and resources and energy into producing something new which benefits people, say some new infrastructure or a new school or training people to do something they couldn't do before, then you're creating real worth. That's wealth creation. But if you simply use your money, say, lending it out to others, well, the money already exists. You're not actually producing any goods and services for them. You're just using your power as someone with spare cash relative to people who don't have enough to extract income from them. So a lot of so-called investment is just wealth extraction. And you read any sort of airport lounge, get rich quick book, and what it'll tell you is not you need to work so much harder than you already are working. It'll tell you you need to get hold of these assets which provide you with unearned income just by controlling them, like shares and so on, and other financial instruments. And they call these investments. They don't call them unearned income, of course. They avoid that term, but it's an old one. And we seem to be forgetting that term just when it's becoming more and more important. That's the difference.
And what is problematic about that? I mean, you know, theoretically, at least, right? I mean, this is anybody can go and buy that book at the airport or take it out from the library, I guess, and follow that prescription. What is wrong with that in the context of the greater society?
Well, if I buy some stocks in an American company, the likelihood is that they're secondhand. I'm buying them secondhand. And so the money I pay doesn't go to the company. It goes to the previous owner of those stocks. And I'm not in any real sense investing in the company. I'm not helping them create wealth. I may possibly help push up their share values, but that depends upon what is going on. What I'm doing is buying an entitlement to a source of unearned income, which is the dividends which I may get from that, plus any speculative gains I can make from buying and selling them. I'm not actually contributing to the production of goods and services. I mean, the real wealth creators are people who produce goods and services, and they can be teachers, they can be cleaners, they can be farmers, they can be software engineers, all sorts of things. But they are actually contributing directly or indirectly to the production of goods and services. But if you just buy stocks, then you may make a lot of money, but in all probability, you're not actually helping the construction of new sources of real wealth. You're not involved in wealth creation. You're involved in wealth extraction. And the more mutual funds and pension funds and so on get involved in buying financial securities like stocks and bonds, of course, their price gets driven up. And so they make even more money. But the money that they make has got to be cashed out sooner or later, and it only has value, again, if there are goods and services to buy with it, and they in general are produced by other people.
Well, what do you say to the response that, well, that it's true that if I buy stocks from you, right, it's not an investment, the company sees none of that, right? How do you respond to the critique? Well, okay, I buy stock from you, but you bought it from the company through some type of offering, and you bought it through the company only because you anticipated that someone like me would come around and pay you a little more for it.
Sorry, can you repeat that last bit?
Well, I mean, you buy stock from the company, right?
Yeah.
And your motivation is anticipating that someone like me will come by and buy it from you at a slightly higher value.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, if it's a so-called initial public offering, well, the money does go to the company, and possibly they may use it for real investment. But actually, most companies fund their real investment internally from whatever cash reserves they have. So most share dealings, 99% probably, are secondhand ones. Those initial share public offerings, as they're called, they get a lot of publicity, but they're not what really matters. It's the secondhand market which is really the big thing. And you have to ask, you know, even in the case where you're buying an initial public offering, you're buying the shares to start off with, well, why should you have more say in the running of the company than a worker, an employee, who could have worked for that firm for decades, but has never been allowed any say in it. And why should shareholders be the prime stakeholders in companies when they may have no interest whatsoever in the viability of the business, only in whatever they can extract from it? So I think that employees and, to some extent, customers or users should be the prime stakeholders in companies, not shareholders.
Well, let's talk about this concept of a moral economy. I mean, because, and I want to ask, are we really just talking about different visions of the way that society should be organized, or can these be judged on another metric aside from what you or I might see as a better, more just vision for society? Are there other metrics in which to judge this upon?
Okay, well, I argue that in some sense, every economy is a moral economy, including capitalism, in the sense that it provides its own moral justifications for what it does. It has certain ideas about what is just and fair, but the way it's organized is not based upon a discussion, a rational deliberation, if you like, upon how things should be done. They're based upon power as that evolves over historically. And so the rules tend to benefit the rich. You know, always remember the golden rule. Those with the gold make the rules. And so we have to assess the legitimacy of the justifications which are provided for institutions. And I've just been questioning the legitimacy of rent. I've just been questioning the legitimacy of absentee shareholding. And that's exactly what we've got to do. And, you know, these are based upon arguments about justice and fairness. Yes, those are sometimes difficult arguments, but actually many of the practices which we think are normal in one sphere of life, we find abnormal in another. And a very good example of this is lending at interest, or usury, as it used to be called, where, you know, if you're hard up and you having difficulty paying your bills, and you know that I could lend you $1,000 and quite comfortably, and I say, yeah, okay, I'm going to charge you 5% interest, and if you don't pay me back, I'm going to seize $1,000 plus interest of your property back. Well, if we were friends, that would be the end of the friendship, wouldn't it? And you would it'd be absolutely clear to you that I, as the stronger power, the economically the lender, was taking advantage of your weakness. And that's why we think it's, in that sphere of life, we think that's unacceptable. But in the capitalist economy, we accept it as perfectly normal. We expect interest on our savings, and I question that. And we have payday loans, companies making ridiculous amounts of interest. Well, that's what they used to call usury. And we now have the IMF and other institutions making huge amounts of money out of indebted countries. And so the IMF has, since 2010, has made 2.5 billion euros out of Greece, because Greece has paid back its loans with interest. And I think we should be questioning these moral rules, that this kind of practice is acceptable.
Tell us just the concept of improperty as one of those, I guess, sort of, I don't know if it's fair to even say reinterpreting. I mean, because these are ideas that I think have been concurrent with the system that we now have. But just tell us of that term improperty.
Yeah. Well, let me say that I'm in favor of private property. A lot of people expect me not to be, but I am. And I'm in favor of social property where that's appropriate. But what I'm against is this thing called improperty. It's a term coined by an old political economist about 100 years ago called J.A. Hobson. And let's take private property. You own your own home. You live in it. You use that house to live in. That's fine. That's private property. No problem with that. But if you start buying up other housing which already exists, and then with no intention of living in them because you've already got your own home, And then you use that as just as a source of income and extract rent from other people, then that's what Hobson called improperty. And or property without function is another theorist called Tawney who called it that. And so again, improperty is our assets which are owned not for direct use of them, for making things with or living in, but for extracting income from other people who are in a much weaker position, who need that. They're students needing housing or something like that.
And so how do you, so I mean, if that is the principle that defines improperty, right? That is something that you own exclusively to extract wealth from. Where do you draw the line, or is it on a case by case basis on those things where private property is acceptable and preferred versus socially owned property?
Well, I mean, that question, where do you draw the line? I'm always a bit suspicious, if I may say so, because there are lots of cases where lines are a little bit fuzzy.
Right.
I mean, the distinction between night and day is fuzzy. I don't know where to draw a line, but I know the difference, and it's a big difference, and it's an important one. And, yeah, there may be situations where people get a little bit of money from their private property. And I'm arguing that we should focus on where they get a lot. You know, a lot of people may have a little bit of improperty which supplements their earned income. But there are some people whose income comes almost entirely from improperty. And if you look at the so-called high net worth individuals who have over $1 million dollars in property other than the home in which they live in and all the consumer durables they use, in other words, other than their private property, then most of their assets are in things like other property, improperty, stocks and shares and bonds and other financial instruments, which are all forms of improperty in most cases. So there are big rentiers. A rentier is someone who lives off or has an income stream in the form of unearned income from improperty. There are small-time rentiers and there are big-time ones. Yeah, let's focus on the big-time ones first.
And so is that the way – I mean, I agree with you that it's there's some editorializing, I guess, in terms of where we draw the line. But I guess really let me rephrase that question, and perhaps you've already sort of at least half answered it. Is it a function of when we make that determination as to what should be private property and what should be social property?
Okay.
Is it a function of what we allow individuals to amass, or is it a function of what we perceive is providing is most suited to providing the most amount of people benefit?
Well, there's always going to be a tension between what benefits some collectivity and what benefits individuals. And, you know, I'm in favor of quite a lot of individual private property. In some cases, it's a matter of prudence, you know, rather than everybody individually paying for something which they need but which they're not going to use very much. They might see it as in their collective interest to buy that in common and share it, get together and pool resources and do that. And we do that with a lot of social insurance, more in Europe than the US. It makes sense to do that. Another example is railways. In Britain, railways have been privatized, which has resulted in making travel unnecessarily difficult and expensive just within the small island that they live in. And there's a debate about whether to renationalize it. And a railway is an interconnected system. It needs to be run as a whole. And so the parts all fit together. And so there's a kind of, logistical, prudential, if you like, rational reasons for doing it collectively. And so where benefits are shared, where costs are shared as well, there may be benefits for all.
And
in social property, I mean.
In social property, yes. Yeah. All right. So So lastly, I mean, so is that basically the recipe to achieve, I guess, a more provisioning style of economy, right? An economy, yeah, that is sort of built to provide, as opposed to built to provide a hierarchy.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, there are many ways of organizing economies if you look at it historically and across culturally, and they all have advantages and disadvantages. But there's one particular factor which we haven't got onto and wouldn't like to leave out, which is climate change. And the present dominant economy we've got, capitalism, is addicted to growth and unsustainable consumption and production. We are trashing the planet and producing global warming, which is going to threaten, which is already threatening many people, and will threaten the quality of life of future generations. And so a new factor comes into play, which is how much should we consume? How much is it okay to consume? And, you know, the 7% of the richest people in the world account for 50% of global emissions, which is 50% too much, because we're exceeding what the Earth can absorb by 50%. So we urgently have to rethink how we organize economies.
Well, I certainly, I guess hope springs eternal. Andrew Sayer, professor of social theory and political economy at Lancaster University, UK. The book is Why We Can't Afford the Rich. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Right, bye now. Bye-bye. All right, folks, going to head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will talk about the demise of the Scott Walker campaign. We will talk about the absence of sanity in the man Ben Carson. We will also, we may get to the ad that destroyed Carly Fiorina's political aspirations back in 2010. We will also do a flashback. Boy, we got to really, it's a full-on right-winger. But we're also going to play this sound from this, I think the guy's a sociopath, frankly. And to be honest, I don't have the knowledge about the way drugs are rolled out and developed and delivered in our society to really do the type of takedown that I'm quite convinced someone with even a working knowledge, fairly rudimentary working knowledge of this stuff, could do. But when you listen to this guy talk, and I'm talking about this guy, Martin Shkreli, I think it is. He is a hedge funder who apparently has a lot of, there's a lot of investigations going, lawsuits surrounding this guy for different things. Justifying the purchase of a drug that has been on the market for 60 some odd years at this point, that essentially is given to people with AIDS and children who have compromised immune systems. It was selling for $13.50 a tablet. He is raising the price, or they have risen the price to, I think, over $700 per tablet. And to hear him talk about it and try and justify it is stunning. And it doesn't express all that's wrong with our society, although it comes pretty close. It comes pretty close. The other part is, I think we could round that out between the peanut executive who's going to prison, the Volkswagen executives who, I don't even say cut corners. They cheated all of us. And Exxon, who has new documents continue to come out showing how much they've known about global climate change and have and how much they've spent on attempting to deny its existence. I mean, all of those things together make a very strong argument that we need more regulation, that operating in their own interests is not, or individuals operating in their own interest is not necessarily lead to a better society for all. I mean, this is, this stuff is just, it's crazy. It's crazy. I just, you listen to this sound of this guy who's on Bloomberg TV, this young guy, maybe under 30, seems 30s, extremely young.
30s. Young guy.
And really does seem
20s or 30s, young
like
dude.
A sociopath.
Definitely a sociopath.
You just can't. I mean, I just couldn't help but think, like, God, I would, if I had the money, I would fund people to harass this guy in his daily life on a daily basis. Like, just like a team of people. You know how they had those things, like, you could hire people to do, like, pranks on? That's, I would just set up, like, a team of pranksters who would just sort of follow this guy around and just make his life just slightly more uncomfortable. But guys like this, they crash and burn in some ways. But the fact that this is possible, I mean, this guy's sort of like got is providing the same service that Trump provides us in some way, because he's so naked with this. And you know, this is a dynamic that goes on in all of the major drug companies. It's just, this guy's completely naked about it. We will talk about that as well. The number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Should remind you that this show, we go through periods where we lose members. And much of it is economic. And, we work out deals with people in those situations. But if you are one of the listeners of this program who can afford to support it on a daily basis, please do. By becoming a member, you go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Just go to majority.fm, click on the link, bookmark it. I mean, click on the link. Click on the link and become a member. Also, you can support this program by getting your coffee from justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. You will love the coffee, I promise you. And you get a 10% discount using the coupon code MAJORITY. You can get the Majority Report blend. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Don't forget, in the next day or two, either tomorrow or Thursday, I mean, I guess plan on doing this on Thursday, I'm going to ask you to subscribe to our new podcast. It's not a political show per se. And I am not directly involved in it. Neither is Matt or Michael. But it's a sports podcast that really deals with sports and more broadly in society. But at the very least, regardless of your interest in such a thing, it is to help this program ultimately. So we're looking for you guys just to subscribe, download the first couple of shows, listen if you're interested. And if you like it, give it a rating or a review. It will help us in the broader project that we have here. So we're going to take a break, 646-257-3920. Just a reminder, tomorrow will be a Matt and Michael Wednesday. I will be going to Temple and fasting tomorrow because it's Yom Kippur. And I practice that tradition. I will be back on Thursday, obviously cleansed of all my sins. starting back at zero again on Thursday. We will be talking to Frank Rich. We will be right back after this.